So I'd like to welcome everybody this morning to administering your Microsoft SQL Server GeoDatabase. And thank you all for coming out. How's the conference going? Thumbs up for everybody? Everybody's brain's full? Yeah, my brain's full, and I haven't actually been listening to sessions the whole time, so good to see. All right, so my name is Shannon Shields. I'm a product engineer on the GeoDatabase team. I work with about 10 different database platforms, but my favorite is SQL Server, and that's where I spend most of my time. And with me is Chet Dobbins, who is a SQL Server product engineer, as well as Ron Lazar. So we all work together. If you end up having a problem that tech support can't resolve, we're usually the people who work on it. So be nice to us. All right. So I stuck this slide in to sort of give a little bit of idea about what we're going to talk about in this session. In years past, we've had a couple of different SQL Server sessions, and an introduction to administration and an advanced topics. And so we were able to say, oh, if you're a beginner, come to the intro session, and if you've been doing this for a while, come to the advanced session. But over the years, more and more sessions, less time, fewer rooms, and we've merged these all into one session. So we try to give everybody something to take away. So basically, if you're who's a GeoDatabase administrator who also got tasked with running the SQL Server instance? Yeah. Who is just a DBA? Okay, so we have a few of you. Anybody not sure what a DBA means? So everybody, yeah, okay. But everybody here stores their data in a SQL Server database or is intending on storing their data in a SQL Server database. So that you're all in the right spot. And we've probably all seen this graphic on the side that is sort of the WebGIS world, where we have a variety of different clients. They all can connect to Portal. Portal can serve up data and services from ArcGIS Server, from ArcGIS Online. But where is all that data living? This is what always bothers me about this graphic, is that the data is just not really there. And in a session like this, to put everything into context, I made sure we had a really big database in the middle of it, because data is the most important part of any organization, really. If you don't have data, what are you working with? What are you analyzing? What are you displaying? What are you conveying information from? It's all about the data. So in our case, the data lives inside a SQL Server database. We can connect directly to it from an ArcGIS desktop or pro client. We can connect to it from ArcGIS Server, serve up data from that database to a variety of different clients. But at the end of the day, all of the data lives in a SQL Server database, and we are tasked with managing that data, making sure it's accessible, available, and safe. So we're going to go over in this presentation a whole series of things that I think are tasks that everybody who is working with SQL Server to GeoDatabase has to perform at some point and sort of understand and be able to work with. So we're going to talk about configuring SQL Server to support GeoDatabases, creating GeoDatabases. Once your data is in a GeoDatabase, how do you control who can access that data? How do I make sure that my data is safe? And last but definitely not least, some tips on maintaining good performance. But before we get into all of that, I'm going to talk about the news since the last user conference. So how many of you, this is your first user conference? Okay, so quite a number of you. How many of you have been in this presentation before? So we have some return guests. All right, so the news since the last UC will be news to some of you. If you've never been here before, I usually try and start these sessions with sort of the stuff that we want to push out to you now, like current information. So we're talking about what is new at 10.4 and 10.4.1. Support for SQL Server 2016. So the latest release of SQL Server shipped on June 1st. I think the system requirements page for SQL Server GeoDatabase support does not list it yet, but it should shortly, as soon as tomorrow. because we have been working with 2016 for over a year now, and ArcGIS 10.4, 10.4.1, as well as Pro 1.2 and 1.3, which will be available shortly, they all work and support SQL Server 2016. There is a new ODBC driver, which Microsoft will be making available in the next couple of months. It is the driver that supports 2016 and earlier versions, and it's called ODBC driver 13 because we want to keep everybody on their toes. I won't even go there. The last one was called 11, and it shipped with 2014, so I'm not really too sure how the numbering works there. But the latest ODBC driver is supported at 10.4.1. So if you are looking at upgrading to a 10.4 release and a new version of SQL Server, I really recommend you go to 10.4.1 and you lay down 2016. And that is going to give you, from this date, the longest set of supported software. If you intend on sitting on something for a while, I always recommend to go to the newest flavor that's out there. Microsoft publishes a document, or it's online, and it is a big matrix for their support dates. So when things cycle out of mainstream support, extended support, and when they're completely deprecated. What we tend to do is line up our releases to support the stuff that is in mainstream release with Microsoft. So as soon as a product for Microsoft moves out of mainstream release, so the example would be 2008 and 2008 R2 moved out of mainstream release in 2014, we don't support those releases with 10.4. So 10.3.1 was the last release that supported those. So if you sort of are looking ahead to figure out, can I upgrade to a version of SQL Server and sit on it for a few years, when a version moves out of mainstream support, our next release usually is the last release to support that version of SQL Server. And because Microsoft is now shipping something every 2 years, that sort of speeds up a bit. When they sat with a database for, you know, 5 or 8 years before they released a new version, that availability date stretched out. But now they seem to be coming at us fast and furious with new stuff. But the good news is, of course, the upgrades for SQL Server are fairly issue-free and pretty easy to do. Your databases just stay in place, you upgrade the database instance, and ta-da, now you're working with the next release of SQL Server. So some other big changes that came for our software stack at 10.4 are substantial changes to our transaction model. Now, for most of you, this will be completely invisible. It's just that behind the scenes, we are doing things quite differently. But we do require that databases have snapshot isolation and read committed snapshot isolation levels enabled at the database. So when you upgrade, we do this for you automatically. When you create a new geodatabase, we do it for you automatically. But we also recommend if you are using a 10.4 client like ArcMap 10.4 or Pro 1.3 or 1.2, and you're connecting to an older geodatabase, so your geodatabase is, say, at 10.3.1, but your clients are newer, we recommend that you also enable these parameters on the older databases and geodatabases. So there's a knowledge base article that talks about this change and what parameters to enable. And I think when Ron shows you setting up a geodatabase, he'll indicate where those options are. They're really easy to toggle on and off. So we talked about the supported versions, 2016 with 10.4 releases, and 10.3 releases were the last ones to support 2008 and 2008 R2. And if you want to use the newest ODBC driver that's not actually available yet, we are supporting it with 10.4.1. The reason why it's not just automatically supported by our software is that our software actually has to look for the available drivers by name that are installed on your machine. We didn't actually know that there was going to be a new ODBC driver until after 10.4 had shipped, because Microsoft only made it available in preview earlier this year. So the ODBC driver 13 and 11 both work with 2016 without any issues, so you can use either of those drivers. But if you're using 10.4.1, I recommend that you go to the 13 driver, simply because it's the latest release. And when Microsoft makes fixes available, they're made available in the latest, the newest software first. So now we're going to move into some of the common questions when we're working with SQL Server. First being, how do I configure SQL Server to support geodatabases? And this is pretty straightforward. We've all installed SQL Server. It's basically a matter of clicking Next a bunch of times, and it all just installs. And you can do that, and you can run a geodatabase. But there are a couple of things that you want to be aware of. First, obviously, you want to install a supported version of SQL Server. Now, generally speaking, we don't prevent you from connecting to an unsupported release. So I did talk to somebody the other day who was using 10.4 against SQL Server 2005. It was an older geodatabase he was connecting to, because we're not going to let you create a new one on 2005, but we're not going to stop you from connecting to it. It's just if you run into problems and something's not working the right way, and it's only on that version of SQL Server that it doesn't work that way, technical support is going to tell you you need to upgrade because it's not a supported combination. So if you go to the SQL Server system requirements for ArcGIS on the documentation site, there will be a list of the supported versions for that version of ArcGIS. So if I'm using a 10.4 client, even if my geodatabase is, say, a 10.2.2 geodatabase, it's not supported to make that connection if the geodatabase is on SQL Server 2008. We're not going to prevent you from doing it, but if there are problems, the solution may actually be to upgrade to a supported release. So if 10.2.2 was sitting on 2012, I can connect no problem from 10.4. That would be a supported combination. So when you are planning for upgrades to your organization and you're looking at upgrading your geodatabase and upgrading your clients, be aware for all of the database platforms that we support that there is a set of combinations that are supported and other ones that are not. And it's generally speaking, if you've got 10.4 in the mix, your SQL Server version has to be at 2012 or higher, even if your geodatabase is technically old enough to support an older release of SQL Server. The other thing to watch out for doesn't affect too many people, but if you are installing SQL Server to run under a language other than English, make sure that the collation that you choose is a case-insensitive collation, as ArcGIS does not support case-sensitive collations. This has to do with how character data gets compared and sorted in SQL Server, whether case factors in or case doesn't. So if I have, is capital A the same as lowercase a? And most of the searches that we do are case insensitive, but a lot of string comparison functions in our software stack do not play well with case sensitive collations in a database. If you're just hitting next and accepting all the defaults, nothing to worry about. Now, when you install SQL Server, by default, it's using Windows authentication only, meaning all of the logins that connect to SQL Server are actually Active Directory or operating system Windows logins. You can change this at any time to also accept SQL Server managed logins. If you intend on having SQL Server managed logins in your instance, make sure you check this and set an appropriate SA password. You can turn it on after you've installed SQL Server. But if you ignore this piece and later you go and create users inside a SQL Server lets you do that. They just won't be able to connect. The reason being is that the authentication mode just says who's allowed to connect. It doesn't actually say I'm not going to let you create SQL Server users. It's just not going to let them connect. And that's something you can turn on afterwards. Now, SQL Server browser, who knows what the browser is for? Just a couple of people. So when you install SQL Server, there's a service that runs called the SQL Server browser, and I believe by default it is disabled. If you have a lot of other people connecting to your SQL Server instance, which I'm assuming you do, you don't just have SQL Server and your client on the same machine, what the browser does is incoming connections just get made, generally speaking, to a SQL Server instance name. But that instance name is actually a combination of the server itself and the TCP port that that instance is listening on. So a default instance of SQL Server is listening on a static port of 1433. And if you don't have the browser running, it usually just works anyway because it's the default. But if you have a named instance of SQL Server, so it's the machine name, backslash, and some name you've given it during the install, by default, those ports are dynamically allocated. So every single time you start up SQL Server, it's listening on a different port. And it's the browser service that is taking those incoming requests and putting them on the right port. So if the browser is not running and you don't specify a port number when you connect, your connection's not going to happen. So I recommend, generally speaking, that the browser is running. It makes things a lot easier. However, if you don't want to have the browser running, make sure that you go and set your instance of SQL Server to listen on a static port. You know what the port number is, and all the users that make a connection have to specify a port number along with the name of the server in their connection. So that's the role of the browser. It's doing essentially port name resolution behind the scenes for you. So when we connect to SQL Server from any ArcGIS client, so this would be ArcMap and Catalog and Pro and ArcGIS Server, they all require a standalone DLL from Microsoft. So this is that ODBC driver I mentioned. Earlier, this was provided as something called the SQL Server Native Client. The native client used to contain multiple client drivers. They dispensed with all of those, and it's just the ODBC driver now. So they've renamed it to the ODBC driver. It's essentially the same thing, just you know, the latest release of it. These are always available for download from Microsoft. We also make them available from the myesri.com site, so you can go and get them there. We don't have the 13.1 up there yet because it isn't in final release yet. It's still in preview. My recommendation is to make sure that it is the same or newer version than your SQL Server that you're connecting to. The exception, obviously, is going to be if you are using 10.4, you need the 11 driver to connect to SQL Server 2016. They're always going to be backward compatible. They are usually forward compatible, but only for a certain number of releases. So if you're using the SQL Server native client for 2012 and you're connecting to 2016, I would recommend that you upgrade the driver. SQL Server, again, doesn't normally block them, but they're not, technically not supported forward through that many releases. So try to make sure you have the newer one. And it needs to be installed on every single client that makes a connection. If you don't have it, you're going to get that message that pops up telling you that you don't have the correct client driver installed. When you see that message, it generally means that you're missing this driver. Yeah. Yes, so the question is, if you're installing 10.4.1, which driver do you install? So right now, the ODBC driver 13 is not readily available. 11 is fine. And 11 will be fine for a while. But at some point, you're probably going to want to upgrade to the 13 ones. The drivers are super fast to install. I mean, they just take a minute, and they're a really small little file. And Ron's going to show you how to identify which ones are installed on your machine. And I'm going to get Ron to do that right now. Oh, you've got one. Okay, I'm not going to breathe while he's talking. What number are you?
Five. Okay. Can everyone hear me? No?
Louder.
How about now? Good? Okay, so I'll show you a little bit of what Shannon was talking about. So if you want to connect to a database or a geodatabase in SQL Server, first, you need to make sure your SQL Server instance can accept connections from remote computers. If you've installed SQL Server Standard or Enterprise, this usually is not an issue. But it's a good idea to check that TCP/IP is enabled and the SQL Server browser is started if you're encountering connection issues. So let me just show you really quickly the SQL Server browser settings. So it's under the SQL Server services, and then you'll see SQL Server browser listed, and on my machine it's running. And then if you click on protocols for SQL Server, you'll see that TCP/IP is enabled. Next, you need to have a SQL Server client installed on the computer where ArcGIS is running. The client must be the same version or higher than the database you'll be working with. There are a couple of options here. The ODBC driver 13, which is new at SQL Server 2016, still at preview, or the ODBC driver 11, each containing new features as well as all the features that ship with ODBC and SQL Server native client, and the SQL Server native client itself. We began supporting ODBC driver 13 with ArcGIS 10.4.1. So now let me show you a quick way of determining what clients you have installed on your computer. So I've created a little batch file that will list the clients that are installed on my computer. So let's go ahead and run this file. So it lists three clients. The first one is my native client, which is shipped as part of SQL Server 2012. Then my ODBC 11 driver, which is part of 2014. And then the ODBC driver 13, which is the latest with SQL Server 2016. Back to you, Shannon.
Okay. You want to show that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot one thing. There's an alternative method to looking for the drivers that are installed on your machine. So if you open up your ODBC Data Source Administrator and you click on the Drivers tab, you'll notice that the three drivers that I just showed you are listed here as well. So we have the 11 driver, 13, and the native client. Well, there's an executable, and it runs within a few seconds, and it lays down these files.
Yeah, so the question is, how do I install these, basically? You can't just copy the driver over. There is an MSI. And so when you do the download, you get an MSI, and you run it, and it's pretty straightforward. And I think it can be done as an unattended installation as well and pushed out that way to a bunch of different clients. The other thing, and I don't know if I have the locations super easily accessible, but when you install a SQL Server patch or cumulative update, and you install it onto your SQL Server instance, and it won't be here for me to show you right now. Is it under the?
No, I think it's under the 110.
Or the 110 folder. Okay, 130. All right, okay, so when you install SQL Server and you install a patch or a cumulative update, if they patch the ODBC driver as part of that update, that's obviously a client. Sometimes, but not always, they'll make the driver available as a separate download on the patch site. But oftentimes they don't. But you can go into the Setup Bootstrap folder, and if there is a specific update to the client, sometimes they will deliver the MSI for that client in this folder location. They don't really document it, but that's how they sometimes send the updates out. And I've kind of had to go back and forth with support at Microsoft sometimes saying, hey, this is kind of clunky, and it's a lot easier if you just say, here's the setup files for the patch and here's the setup files for the client as two separate things, but they don't always do that. So if you notice that the version of the ODBC driver that installs with SQL Server has bumped up relative to what you've got installed on your client machines, go take a look in the install location for your version of SQL Server. So you can see on here, I've installed a bunch of different SQL Server versions on here over time and upgraded them. So I end up with all of these different folders. The most recent one that I put on here is listed as 13, which is the version for 2016, because, of course, they can't get their numbers to line up. But in the 130 folder, they have this setup bootstrap location. And I can't remember exactly which folder it is. I think it is the final install folder in here. You'll find .msis for things that need updating, and you'll see the ODBC driver MSI if it's available, if it's something that you need to install. What I thought was interesting with the 2016 final installation is that they did bump the version number on the driver, but they don't yet have an MSI, an installer, or a publicly available driver at that same final release. So the one that's out there now is simply in preview, and it's a couple of months old. It works, but you just have to update it at some point. Okay, so now that I've got SQL Server installed, I want to go about creating databases. A database in SQL Server is a logical construction that is made up of one or more files to store all the data and one or more files to store all of the modifications or transactions against your data. So if you just go into SQL Server and say, create database, give it a name and hit enter, you're going to get a database. It's going to be really, really small, and it's going to have some not great parameters set up for it. Like it's going to the files are going to automatically grow in tiny little increments. You can go in and control anything you want about the storage of that database, and that's where all of your data lives. You can have up to 32,000 odd databases on a single instance of SQL Server. I think I encountered somebody who had over 10,000 databases on their instance once. He has my sympathies. I don't know if I'd want to maintain that many, but you can have several, and there's, you know, not really any difference in having several versus having one big one in terms of resource usage on your server. They're just kind of a way to logically organize your data. So databases tend to be related to a specific theme. All of the security in SQL Server is done at the database level. So people connect to SQL Server, and we'll talk about this later, but actually being able to see any data, they have to be given access to individual databases. And GeoDatabase is an ArcGIS construction that is hosted inside a database. It's a one-to-one relationship, one GeoDatabase, one SQL Server database, which means you can also have multiple GeoDatabases on a single instance. And it is essentially a series of tables and stored procedures and functions that our software will write into a SQL Server database. And when we connect to that database, we will check for certain things, and then we know it's a GeoDatabase. We have a couple of different options for creating GeoDatabases, and Ron is going to go over them. They're all done by use of a geoprocessing tool. Sometimes that tool can create the entire database for you. Other times, it can run in an existing database and just populate that existing database with all of the GeoDatabase objects. So, take it away, Ron.
So every organization has rules and processes that determine how a geodatabase will be set up. If you perform the role of both the database administrator and the geodatabase administrator, and therefore know the password for both logins, you can use the Create Enterprise Geodatabase Geoprocessing Tool or a Python script to create a geodatabase in SQL Server. If the person creating the geodatabase does not have access to the database administrator's password, the database administrator can set up the database and create the geodatabase administrator's login, user, and schema. Then the geodatabase administrator can connect to the database with that login and create a geodatabase using the Enable Enterprise Geodatabase Geoprocessing Tool. First, I want to show you the Create Enterprise GeoDatabase tool. So this is ArcGIS Pro 1.2, and I will use the Create Enterprise GeoDatabase tool and enter some parameters. So my instance is my computer, RLZR. We'll call this database UC underscore DBO. Enter the SA password, which is the system administrator. And since I'm creating a DBO schema, so I will uncheck the SD-owned schema option and load my authorization file. So we'll run that. So now, currently I'm creating a geodatabase as the database administrator. So it's complete. Now let's take a look at the geodatabase properties in SQL Server. You can ignore this SQL for now. I'll get into that in a little bit. So I'll refresh my databases, and here's my newly created geodatabase. Let's take a look at all the tables that were created. So you can see the SD schema. The DBO schema with the SD tables were created. Stored procedures that were loaded. And let's take a look at some of the database properties. So here you can see the size of the geodatabase that was created. So in ArcGIS, when ArcGIS Pro is used to create a geodatabase, it's 625 megabytes. That's the default. So 500 megabytes for, is it the data file?
Yeah.
And 125 megabytes for the log files. Log file. The other option I want to show you, well, two options. Two of the options that Shannon mentioned earlier. When we create a geodatabase using our tools at ArcGIS Pro 1.2, here you see the allow snapshot isolation is set to true, and the is read committed snapshot on set to true. Next, I want to show you the option where the geodatabase administrator is a different person. So what we have here is a script which the database administrator has to run to create the database. And in this case, it's called UC underscore SDE. Set some database options here. We will create the SDE login with a default schema and an authorization, and then grant the necessary permissions to this user so it can create the geodatabase. So in this case, what we will do is use the enable enterprise geodatabase GP tool. So I have a script here which will basically enable this geodatabase. So the parameters here are, there are two parameters. This is my connection file, the first parameter. And the second parameter is my license file. So I can run this in the command line. And let's see what happens. It fails. The reason why? I forgot to run the SQL statement first to create the database. And so for the enable enterprise geodatabase tool to work, the database has to exist. So let's go back to my SQL Server Management Studio and execute the script. Complete it successfully. Now I'll try rerunning this and see what happens. and there should be no more errors. We hope. Okay, it's complete. Now let's go back to Management Studio. Let's refresh our database list. And there's my second database, a geodatabase that was created. And in this case, you'll notice that it's not a DBO schema, it's an SDE schema, because we wanted to create a database owned by the SDE user. And that will do it for this demo. Back to you, Shannon.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. So a couple things in Ron's demo. We get asked a lot, SDE schema, DBO schema, what's the difference? And what Ron was illustrating there, if you notice the list of permissions that were applied to the SDE user in the SDE, in the database he created, were pretty minimal. Create table, create procedure, create view, create function. So the SDE user that owns the geodatabase and manages the geodatabase does not have to have very elevated permissions. So if you are in an organization where no one's allowed to be DBO in a database, nobody has the login that gives them DBO credentials, maybe your database is created for you by the IT department or by a separate database group, and all you can do is play in the database, but you have no control over it, then the SDE schema may be the way that you go. If you run your own SQL Server instance, and you have the ability to run as the DBO user in SQL Server, then you have options. You can create a DBO schema or an SDE schema. In terms of functionality, they are identical. It's just some cases you want multiple people to be able to connect to your instance and do the same high-level thing of administration. In other cases, it's much more restricted, so we have alternatives for both. When Ron ran the first tool to create the geodatabase, his tool created a database as part of it. So the user that runs that tool has to have a high level of permission in SQL Server because the tool is actually creating a database. It is optionally creating a login if you choose to create an SDE schema. But the enable script that he ran requires that a database exists already, that all of the permission required be granted, then the user that's going to own the schema in that database, create the geodatabase objects, they make a connection and run that tool. So the connection file that he provided when he ran that script was made by the SDE user, and the SDE user's name and login were provided in that script. So that's sort of the difference between creating and enabling. Now, some takeaways from that example. When you use the GP tools to create the whole database itself, you get a default size of a single 500 megabyte data file and a single 125 megabyte log file. And they auto-grow, I believe, by 10%. But they're just defaults. It's probably not the size that you actually want for your data files. So if you want more control over the storage, you want multiple data files, you want multiple log files, you want to put them in different places, I always recommend splitting your transaction logs physically far away from your data files. Create the database first, exactly how you want it. Then you can go and run the Create Geodatabase tool. If the database name that you put into that tool already exists, it'll just use it. It won't attempt to create it. So if you want more control, do your thing at the SQL Server level first, then you run the tool to actually populate it with the geodatabase objects. Another thing to note here, even though SQL Server gives you all of these great opportunities to rename databases, if it's got a geodatabase in it, you can't rename it. Well, SQL Server will let you, but when you go to connect to it, you're going to get errors. Reason for this is that we have an awful lot of information contained inside the metadata, stored procedures, functions, actual physical tables that have information about the original name of the database. So even though on restore, on attach, just by right-clicking, you can rename a database in SQL Server, if it's got a geodatabase in it, that's not supported.
If you accidentally do that, can you rename it back and
Yes. That's the way out of it. It's if you have accidentally renamed a database and it's got a geodatabase inside it, just rename it back to what it originally was.
Is there any plan to change that going
forward? I have tried and tried and tried. And I will keep trying, especially now that Oracle has the pluggable instances that you can just rename them over and over and over again to no avail. Part of the reason is way back, you know, if you've been using geodatabases on SQL Server for the past 18 years, you will know that at one point in time, you could create one geodatabase that spanned multiple databases. And we don't support that anymore. I think when we initially started doing it, people were just concerned about the actual limits of an individual database. And those limits just don't exist anymore for SQL Server, but there's a lot of historical code and practices behind it that understood that your data could actually reside in multiple different, like many different databases, and we had to maintain all that information. So that has kind of negatively affected us now, because it would be really nice if you could just rename a database and have the geodatabase be renamed. But unfortunately, that's not the case now, and there are currently no plans to change that. But we'll see.
Did you have a question?
Same question. Okay. One last thing about creating is also upgrading. So whenever we have a release of new software, there is the potential that we have tweaked something inside the database. We're not going to touch user objects, but all of our system objects, we have maybe made a schema change, maybe changed some of the code in a stored procedure, maybe added some objects. When we do a geodatabase upgrade, we are going to write all that new stuff into the database, and we are going to change the version number of that geodatabase. So when you connect to a geodatabase from client software, you can go to the property sheet of that geodatabase, and if you have sufficient permission, you can perform an upgrade. And it's going to indicate to you whether or not there's a difference, a version difference, between the geodatabase and the client you are connecting from. And if there is, you're able to run the upgrade tool directly from the properties dialog. There's also a geoprocessing tool that will do an upgrade for you. We will do some checking ahead of time to make sure that you indeed have the sufficient permissions and that no one else is connected to the geodatabase, some basic stuff. And then we will perform the upgrade. I think the last time there was some really seriously substantial different stuff that happened during an upgrade was between 9.3 and 10.0. Most of the upgrades since then, there have just been a few little minor changes here and there and upping the version. So the upgrades are usually a really straightforward thing to do in SQL Server geodatabases. If you are upgrading a lot of stuff at the same time, like you're going from a different version of Windows, you're moving things to a different server, you're upgrading all of your clients, you're skipping several database releases, you're upgrading SQL Server and the geodatabase, my recommendation is don't do it all at once. Because if you upgrade 16 different things and you fire it all up and you say, oh, this isn't working the way I thought it was going to work, and you call up tech support and they say, well, what changed? And you say, everything changed. It's going to be incredibly difficult to pinpoint what among those changes is actually causing the problem. And I see this often where you talk to people and they say, well, you know, we made everything virtualized and we went from 9.3 to 10.2.2 and we changed all of our services and we changed our operating system. Oh, and we migrated all our data from SD binary to geometry. And you've done 16 different things. Where do you start untangling that? So my recommendation is the order of operations doesn't really matter. In most cases, just do them all differently, like separately, and make sure that all of your workflows are functioning from at each stage. So if you are changing your operating system and virtualizing everything, just carry along all the other stuff exactly the same way. Be happy with that setup first, then go and upgrade SQL Server. And when you're happy with the way that works, then go and upgrade your geodatabase. The order that you do these things doesn't really matter, but the fact that you are doing them separately and testing at each level to see that you haven't introduced something or something hasn't changed your workflow or your performance hasn't suffered then you do the next piece, and it becomes a lot easier to say, this was the only thing that changed, and when this piece changed, this stopped working for me. Yeah. The question is, if I have a versioned environment and I want to do an upgrade, no. I would run a compress and I would make sure I had a good database backup. But the upgrade really should not impact anything with your versioned environment. The only time that things got a little tricky was we made substantial changes to our infrastructure between 9.3 and 10.0. And in that case, there were a lot of things that went differently. Now, we don't, as a rule, touch your data when we do an upgrade. We would never do something during an upgrade that, like, added a field to one of your tables. So that's okay. But whenever there is substantial changes to the structure of the underlying Geo database itself, that's when the upgrade is a little more costly. But in terms of having to, you know, compress everything and drop all of your versions, no, you should not have to do that during an upgrade. Okay. The other thing that happens when you upgrade SQL Server, I'm going to flip over here. When you upgrade SQL Server, so I have upgraded this instance of SQL Server here, and I think this might have been the database. So I'm running SQL Server 2016 right now. I changed this yesterday. Yesterday, this database popped up and said it was SQL Server 2008 compatibility level, which means that this database was probably created back on 2008, and I've just upgraded it along. Upgrading SQL Server does not change this compatibility level setting. This compatibility level setting doesn't normally matter all that much, but occasionally SQL Server will deprecate something or add something new and tie that behavior or that code path to the compatibility level of the database. So the one example right now that would affect ArcGIS users is if you're using the geography storage type. So you're using the SQL Server geography type. At 2008, you couldn't store features that were larger than a hemisphere. At 2012, you could. But that behavior was tied to the compatibility level of the database itself. So you upgraded to SQL Server 2012, but you still couldn't create features larger than a hemisphere in your database, probably because the compatibility level was still sitting at 2008. So I recommend that unless you have another third-party application that is telling you, no, 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 don't change the compatibility level because we are still doing things that require an older compatibility level, as a matter of course, when you upgrade your SQL Server instance, going up the compatibility level of your databases, unless you know specifically not to do this. One example, we had a customer who encountered this years ago. SQL Server, I can't remember when, it might have been 2005, completely deprecated any support whatsoever for doing non-ANSI standard where clause joins. So we want you to use join syntax that is like left outer join, join on these columns. There's a much older syntax that let you do the join syntax in the where clause. Didn't work particularly well for inner and outer joins. It was kind of clunky. You had to use plus signs on either side of the equal. They use it extensively in Oracle, and I've had weird times trying to convert Oracle syntax to SQL Server syntax. But Microsoft just said, I think at 2005, no more. So if you had a third-party application that executed or passed in join syntax that used this old where clause syntax, and you moved your database compatibility level to 2005, those queries would not work anymore. So you need to keep your database compatibility level lower than 2005. But it's a very infrequent thing that you run into a problem changing it. Any database that you create at that version, so new databases that I've created in 2016 are all going to have the 2016 compatibility level automatically, but SQL Server does not change it on upgrade. It's a very easy thing to change. I don't know why I'm losing focus here. You just pick from the drop-down list, and I can, you know, go and change it back and hit OK, and it's changed back. It's basically just directing Microsoft to say certain functionality is available or not available. It doesn't do anything to the data that's stored inside that database. Okay, so next topic, do you guys want to move the mic over? Is how to control access to my data. We're going to do a little dance here with these mics because Chet's going to be doing the next demo. Okay, so when you connect to SQL Server, and I've mentioned this already, logins are the users who are connecting to SQL Server. But once they've connected to SQL Server, it doesn't mean they can actually access any of their data. So users in each database are authorized to perform certain actions in a database to access certain pieces of data. So it's sort of a two-step process. Once you get inside a database, you have these logical groupings of features on these, I'll just call them like little containers, called a schema. Now, if you've been using SQL Server for a long time, you will know that prior to 2005, users and schemas, they were sort of the same thing. So if I'm user Shannon in a database and I go and create a table, it's called Shannon.table. In 2005, they said, no, now it's schema Shannon. Anybody who has permission can create data on the Shannon schema. It's not tied to ownership and tied to a particular person. So it's kind of a nice system, but you will see in ArcGIS, we don't really support it. Part of it is that not every database is designed this way, and also we were running SQL Server databases for a long time before the schema user separation happened, and we have a larger security model in ArcGIS that applies certain behaviors and security to objects that a database doesn't know about. So, for example, somebody creates a feature data set, they own that feature data set, and there are rules to say who is allowed to add things to that feature data set. A database does not know what a feature data set is. A feature data set itself is not stored in a database, just the items in that feature data set. So the ArcGIS rule is the person who creates that feature data set owns that feature data set, and they have to own all of the objects that end up in that feature data set. Translate that down to the database, it means that all of the objects that you put in that feature data set have to have a schema that's the same name as the user that created the feature data set. So our rule basically with SQL Server is for users who are going to create things in your database, like tables and views, must have a default schema name that matches their username. So if I'm adding Chet to my database, and Chet is going to have a role that allows him to create feature classes, I must make a schema called Chet, and that is Chet's default schema. A default schema is the one that you will automatically put things on if you don't specify otherwise. So if Chet says, create my table, and its default schema is something else, that's the schema that the table is going to go on. So our rule is, you're going to create data in a database, your username has to match a schema that is your default schema. Our tools for creating users are going to do that for you automatically. Chet will show you that. But you don't always want to use our tools to create users. You may want to use SQL Server tools. The rule is if those users are going to create objects in the database, they have to have a schema name that matches. And you're going to get a very nice clear error message coming back to you if you go from, say, our catalog and you try to create a new feature class and you don't have a default schema that matches your username, it's going to tell you, and it just won't let you move forward. Now, people who are not going to own objects, people who are just selecting and editing existing data, do not need to have a matching schema. But for users who are going to be creating objects, they have to abide by that rule. Like I said, it's not a SQL Server rule, it's an ArcGIS rule. Yes. Depends on if he's the DBO user in the database or not. So the question is, if I have a user, how do I get them to write to the DBO schema? And we'll talk about that in a couple of slides. They basically have to be the DBO user.
Okay, not just DBO.
No. They have to be the DBO. Yeah. And we will talk about DBO in a couple of slides.
So what happens if you're
Yeah, that's a really good question. If I have, let's say I'm using Windows accounts and that guy leaves the company and I'm left with data that he owns in the database. In the ArcGIS model, you were kind of stuck. You would basically have to go in and copy their data over to a new schema because we don't really support moving data from one schema to another, like sort of renaming an object. So the recommendation from the design perspective is don't do that. Don't have named accounts like that that are associated with an individual at the Windows level own data. Have a headless schema, you know, called like GIS admin or GIS account or whatever that a few people can connect as and create objects. And that account can just be passed around, rather than having things linked to specific people, because when you pull them out of the Active Directory, they no longer exist in the database, but their schema's there.
Yeah. Call
you need to copy their data somewhere else, like to a different schema, yeah. I'm going to take the rest of the questions after so that we sort of stay on track here. Can I take the question later? Yeah. So when we look at establishing permissions for users in a database, I want you to think of a triangle with the people who can do the most stuff. The top of the triangle be the least number of people. And the people who have the least amount of permissions, those are probably the larger number of users. So going with the law of least privileges, only give people absolutely what they need to get their job done and nothing else. If you have the largest group of users in your organization are the ones who are just accessing the data, maybe they're making maps, maybe they're running some queries, but they're not editing, they're definitely not creating objects, just give them select access. Don't give them anything else. Similarly, you've got a group of editors, and all they're going to be doing is editing existing data. They don't need permission to create objects. You can do this role-based. You can have a set of roles in the database that sort of line up with people's jobs. You can move them in and out of roles. It really simplifies things because you're not having to go through this list of objects and grant and revoke permissions to them. But you can have a reader role, and you can have an editor role, and you could have a data creator role. And you can move people in and out of those roles, and their permissions get inherited from the roles. But definitely do not give everybody DBO or sysadmin access to your instance. Similarly, don't give everybody the ability to create data, because you're going to come into your GeoDatabase one day and see 57 different parcel feature classes, all owned by different people. You have no idea what they are. That's called write it out to a file GeoDatabase if you need some scratch space to experiment. But don't give people the ability to do that in your production database, unless, of course, that's what you want. But most of the time, you don't. You want to have a set predefined schema in place, a specific set of people who have the ability to add or change or modify that schema, but everybody else just works with the existing data. And if they need to create something on the fly to play around with, that's either a version or just write it out to a file geodatabase, but it's not part of your production environment. But if you give people permission to do things, they will figure out a way to do it, and they will... You'll end up with that database that's got hundreds of random features that nobody knows what they actually are. So I've mentioned the DBO user a fair amount. Who is DBO? Who thinks they really have a handle on the DBO user? Not seeing a lot of hands go up at all. So not surprising, because it's confusing. So SQL Server has this special user in every single database. It's called DBO, and it's always there. If you are a member of the sysadmin fixed server role, so this is not a database role, this is a role, let me get back here, at the SQL Server level. So I have logins in here, and these logins can have server level permissions. This one does not. This one can just connect to SQL Server, and then I'm going to establish their permission at the database level. If I were to click this button here to say sysadmin, they would now be a member of the sysadmin role, and in every single database, they would be the DBO user. So I can have many sysadmins. They're all the DBO user in the database. So now, this user here, GDB, Let's say he was the GDB user in a database and he had a schema, but the minute I put him in this role, he goes in and creates data, it's on the DBO schema. If you connect and you say, who is this user, it's going to come back and say DBO. So that's the special DBO user sysadmin relationship. Anybody who is a member of the sysadmin fixed server role, so this is the SA user, this is the person who can do everything in your database. This is the person who can shell out to the operating system as an administrator. This is that user. Don't give everybody permission to act as that user. So agencies that say everything lives in the DBO schema sort of playing a little fast and loose with security unless they're really guaranteeing that only one person is the DBO. And that puts a lot of burden on the one person who's the sysadmin for your entire instance, but hey, they also have to do all these schema changes in your geodatabase. But that's DBO. They are a member of the sysadmin role. Who else is DBO? The person who actually owns the database. So when you create a database, that database has an owner. It's usually the sysadmin who's creating the databases, but somebody can be given permission at the server level to create a database without being sysadmin. Any database that they create, they are DBO in that database because they actually own the database. Database ownership can be transferred from one person to another. So if that GDB user login I showed you created a database, and then they left the company, and I said, okay, I'm moving that database over under Chet's ownership. Now Chet would be DBO in that database. So there's a stored procedure you can run to change the ownership of a database. So the owner of the database is DBO. Sysadmins are DBO. Inside a database, there is a fixed database role. So it exists in every database called DB underscore owners. This is where things get confusing. Thank you very much, Microsoft. People who are in the DB owner role are not DBO. So that GDB user I showed you, I could put him in the DB owner role and he'd have DBO-like permissions. So he'd get to do a lot of things at the database level that only the DBO would normally do, but he's not DBO. He's still the GDB user. So I think on the upgrade slide, I'd mentioned that sysadmins, SA user could run an upgrade, so can members of the DB owner role because they have all of the necessary permissions without actually being the sysadmin. So within a database, there's very few things that a member of the DB owner role can't do that a DBO can. There are a couple, but they are not the DBO user. They would still write to their own schemas, not the DBO schema by default. So that's kind of the difference. So the rule of thumb here is don't randomly go and stick people in the sysadmin role. If you have an SDE schema geodatabase, don't put the SDE user in the sysadmin role when you want to elevate their permission for something. If they need to have higher permission for some reason, stick them in DB owner role inside that database. Because the minute you stick them in the sysadmin role, they're not SDE anymore, they're DBO. And there are certain checks within our software that are going to say, who are you and does your name match this? And if it comes back DBO and that doesn't match the name that we think should be returning, there will be errors. So use that very, very sparingly. So I'm going to turn this over to Chet now to talk about managing permissions.
Three. Can everybody hear me? Yes? Okay, so just like we've kind of been talking about the whole time, managing users and things like that is going to be a similar concept to creating your geodatabase. Sometimes you're going to have tasks that you want to manage from a DBA perspective through the enterprise database. Sometimes you want to manage things through ArcGIS. So let's take a look at some different things in ArcGIS of what we can do and what results we get in the database side. I'm going to start by creating a database user. So open up my geoprocessing tool. It's got some inputs I need to input in there. So the first one's my database connection. And in order to create a user, I've got to use an administrative connection. So this connection here is a SA account. I'm just going to drag that in. And then I'm going to input a new username. We're going to call the user Luke. And then a password. We're going to run this. You saw my password was really small and simple, and I wanted to show that if you have Windows password policies, this kind of is a common thing that will pop up for people. If you see it, you immediately know what went wrong. It tells you the Windows policy is not met. You need to make a more complex password. So that's a pretty easy fix. So let's go in and do that. So I'll make this more complicated. Hopefully I can type it again later. There we go. So I've got my new user, and I'm going to hop over into SQL Server Management Studio and take a look at what we've created. So we'll refresh our logins, and you can see my new user down here. It's probably tiny on the screen, but it looks okay. We'll take a look at the properties of my Luke user. And you can see that when I first open it up on the General tab, that password policy is checked. We don't do anything with that, and that's why we get that error if you put in too simple of a password. The next thing we'll look at, like Shannon was showing before, the server roles. We don't do anything in this area either. We add the user to the public role at the server level, but we don't add to any of these other server level roles. We'll take a look at where the user is mapped. So I mapped that user to the UC 2016 database. And we also gave that user a default schema of the with the same name. So that is something that we will do under the hood that doesn't necessarily happen when you manage it from SQL Server side. That can be good, that can be bad, and I'll show you why. I also didn't grant that user any specific roles in the database. Now, there was an option there that if I had a specific role I wanted to add the user to, you can do that. But I didn't check anything, so we are not going to just automatically add a user to a role. All right, so let's go now look at what we have in the database for that user that we added him to. So I'll refresh this entire folder, and we'll start here. There's my Luke user, and if we look in the schemas, we also have that Luke schema. And so the next thing I want to do is take a look at what kind of permissions that Luke user has in this database. So I'll just sort these real quick. And you can see I've got the create table, view, procedure, those permissions that Shannon was talking about for data ownership. If I'm going to be able to create new feature classes in my database, that tool in ArcGIS is going to create a user that can own data. So just be aware of that because you don't want everybody to be able to own data. You want to limit that user. So for the most part, you're going to probably be creating more users from the SQL Server side, and we're going to go do that now. So I'll scroll back down, and I would do a script, but I'm just going to right-click and make something really fast. We'll name this user Han. It's going to be a SQL Server account. And this time I have the privilege to be able to uncheck that box and make an easy password to remember. That's not the one I want, though. There we go. And then I will add this user to the database, and for the sake of it, you never know, we'll give him a schema too. I'm not going to grant him any permissions though. We'll say OK. I now have my Han user here at the bottom. And it looks like that refreshed for me. OK. Anyway, there's my Han user in the database. I've never seen it refresh before automatically. It's nice. I'm going to go back to ArcGIS Pro now. And we're going to take a look at connecting with these users now that we've got them in our database. So I'll first connect as Han. And we're just going to quickly test this user. We're going to try to create a new table under Han's account. We'll run that real fast. And I get an error. The error is exactly what we expected. Create table permission is denied in the database. I gave him a schema. I didn't give him any permissions. So obviously he can't create data. Luke, on the other hand, is where I created it from the ArcGIS side. And that's unexpected failure. Make sure I had typed that password in right. Okay.
I'll just skip that part.
I'll skip that part. So the next thing I want... The next thing I want to do is... is go in, and I was going to show the next part to deal with Windows groups. Now, I don't have a domain account here, so I'm going to use some Windows groups to some local groups that I created on my Windows machine to kind of demonstrate behaviors that you might find with Windows group accounts. So I have a group on my machine called Gangsters, and there's two users in that group, Jabba and Rota. So I'm going to run this script to create the login, add the login to my database, and then grant these create table permissions to that group. I always do that every time. I always highlight. And then we'll refresh. So here's my Gangsters login. We'll refresh the users. There's my Gangsters user. Refresh schemas. I don't have anything there. That's fine. So let's go back to to ArcGIS Pro, and I'm going to have to actually close the one that I've got opened. And we're going to open this up as a new user. I'm going to run this as a different user than I would normally log in as. We'll log in as Jabba. Password should work this time. There we go. And so now I'm actually connected as a Windows user named Jabba. And I'm going to connect to that database here and make a new feature class. We'll name that test. Run the process. It was completed successfully. So we'll connect to the database and just have a quick look at what happened. And if you noticed, I never created a user or a login in that database named Jabba. I did grant the group abilities to create data. That makes sense. But if you notice, my schema owner of this data is actually Jabba. That's not something that we do from ArcGIS. That's not some magic trick that we're doing under the hood. That will actually happen in SQL Server. And if you notice, if I refresh here, I've now got a Jabba user account, and I have a Jabba schema. So taken from that, if you're in SQL Server and you're adding groups and you're granting those groups permissions to do things like create data, SQL Server under the hood is going to create any user in that group as a user in the database, and it's going to create a schema for them to use. So that's something to take from that.
Okay. Thank you, Chet.
Sure.
Yeah, so you can, as a Windows group member, create data on a specific schema, but not through ArcGIS software. ArcGIS software is still going to go with that whole user has to match a schema that is their default schema. So if you are using Windows groups to manage security, I would recommend that the group users are not ones who create data, that we go again, if possible, with that headless account or a single account that houses, whose schema houses all of the data, and manage permissions for, say, editing and selecting at a group level, but not for database or for data owners. So some takeaways from what Chet showed you. Obviously, creating a user doesn't give them access to anything in the data. That has to be managed separately. So once you've created objects, you can assign permission to those objects. I recommend using roles if you've got a lot of users, rather than explicitly granting individual permissions to individual users, because it's a real headache to then go and revoke them and sort of remember this huge matrix of who can access what. Now, ArcGIS tools will manage permissions on all parts of a feature class. So we didn't really show this here, but if I create a feature class and I register it as versioned and I enable historical archiving, how many tables does that feature class actually have? Looks just like one object, but there can be four or five actual objects down at the database level that represent that entire feature class. So if you were going to be managing permissions like this at the database level and granting and revoking in SQL Server, you have to keep track of all of the pieces that are logically a single feature class when you connect through an ArcGIS client. Whereas if I manage permissions on objects in ArcGIS, I right-click, I go to the privileges dialog, and I grant and revoke stuff, it's going to hit all of the right objects under the hood. Whereas if you're doing it at the database level, you're going to have to go and figure out what are all these relationships. Similarly for things like if I have a feature data set, I manage permission at the entire feature data set level. I can't go in and say, oh, in my topology, yeah, these people can edit the whole topology, but these people can only edit part of a topology. It doesn't work that way. It's the whole thing, and you would manage permissions for the entire topology. But what are all the pieces in that topology? SQL Server doesn't know. It's a lot to figure out, but ArcGIS will make sure that all of the right pieces have the correct permission applied to them. And the other thing, like Chet was saying, using the Create Database User tool is going to give you a user that has a lot of permission in the database. And if you want that, that's great because it's putting all the correct permission in there. But if you want to create users that are only going to be editing data, create them at the SQL Server level and then apply permissions at the ArcGIS level. So for this section, I would like everybody who's left in the room, even though it's late and we're running over, to please stand up. All the way up, 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 up. Stretch. You know, you've been sitting down for over an hour. So those of you who have a full-on restoration plan for all of your data that you have practiced. So not only you've backed up your data, but you also know how to restore it and you've tested it more than once, please sit down. So some of you have some work to do when you get back to the office. How many people have never practiced restoring their database backups? Okay, you stay standing. Everyone who's actually backed up their database, just even once, you can sit down. Oh, good. We don't have anybody still standing after that. Last year, we had a lot of people standing, and it was like public shaming. So I'm really glad to see that everybody has at least managed one backup. So how do I make sure my data is safe? Having it striped across a bunch of servers, people who come and say, I'm using a SAN, I'm using a RAID array. No. That's redundancy. That's not safety. So the only way to make sure that your data is going to be available tomorrow after a meteor falls on your server is by backing your data up and practice restoring it. Because I have heard a huge number of horror stories of people who have been, they've got these really elaborate backup plans and they've planned and they've got all this stuff scripted and they're all automated. And then the time comes to actually restore something and they don't work. Because nobody actually ever tested to see a variety of things. Is the backup a good backup? They can be corrupted. Things can happen. I heard a story a while ago of someone who was taking these backup tapes or something off-site, but they were being wheeled in a cart over a bumpy surface, and they think that actually corrupted something on the tape. So they were carefully storing stuff in an offsite backup. They were never actually testing the media, and the media was corrupt. So money and time and who knows what, doing all of this work to back their data up, but at the end of the day when it's important and you need to be able to restore it, it wasn't available. The other thing to look at, when we talked about creating databases and creating multiple files and, you know, setting them up the way you want them, that's also a really important part of your restore strategy. Because if you create one big, enormous, like 64 terabyte database file, and you store all of your data in one file, and you have a server that's big enough to hold it, what happens if something happens to that disk, and you have to restore your data to a set of smaller disks? If you have one big, huge file, you can't do that. But if you have broken that file into smaller components that might fit the available hardware you have, should you need to restore it, you're going to be in much better shape. So you really need, really at the design stage of your database, to start thinking about how you would restore that data in the event of some kind of emergency. Because they happen. We've had people who've contacted us to happily just validate that they were doing all the right things and that they were up and running and it was all good after their office was destroyed in a flood. But their backups were off-site, and they'd practiced restoring them, and when it came time to restore them, they were up as quickly as they had media to put their stuff on. But the statistics for organizations that are down in the long term is pretty bleak. If you can't be up and running sort of within a 24-hour period, the statistics for overall survival are not good. So, and last but not least, and I know we've gone over, and I do this every time, because I just have so much to tell you, maintaining good performance. So There are some standard things at the SQL Server level. They're very well documented online. You can go and search SQL Server documentation sources from Microsoft, as well as billions of blog posts by the very active SQL Server community that give you all sorts of recommendations for managing overall performance, how to identify things that are performing poorly, how to identify when you have aged statistics, when your indexes are fragmented, all that sort of basic database administration 101 stuff. So that applies to an ArcGIS database the same way it would apply to any other database out there. When you're working with ArcGIS, you also have things like in a versioned environment, making sure that you are compressing on a regular basis. You don't necessarily have to compress everything up to zero, but regular compresses get rid of redundant information and keep your database or data at a more manageable size. So all those sorts of things need to be done on a regular basis, but also verify that you do need to do them before you embark on some plan that is updating statistics every afternoon and then wondering why your performance kind of sucks later in the afternoon after you've updated all your statistics, because you've probably made all of your cached execution plans invalid and it needs to act like it's the beginning of the day and re-query everything. So make sure that you sort of understand your database. Another thing to do is when you've got up and running and you're really happy with the way things are performing, benchmark that information. Run the performance monitor for an afternoon. Go and run some SQL Server traces so that you're collecting information that says, these are the throughput numbers that are good for us. This is the performance that people are happy with. So that when people come and say, this is running really slowly, you have an idea of how much something has slowed down or what is slow. But we often get calls from people saying, it's really slow. And you say, well, was it ever fast? Like, what, you know, was it, when you say it's really slow, what does that mean? Slow for you today and it wasn't slow yesterday? Or has this been a gradual slowing down? So in order to be able to keep good performance, you have to understand what that good performance is and have some numbers out there. There are a lot of tools and sort of best practices for map documents, for services, where what it really comes down to is you're not over-querying the database. So you have set things like scale dependencies layer in your map documents so that when you zoom way out, you're not retrieving 50 million shapes, and when you zoom in, you're not retrieving a whole bunch of stuff that's not necessarily in your map. Things like maintaining decent indexes for the type of queries you're doing. We build a bunch of indexes to support what we know about data. But if you have things like definition queries on a layer, I don't know what that is. You are going to have to build an appropriate index for that where clause. The other thing that people ask a lot of questions about is spatial index performance. And I love spatial indexes. I could spend weeks and weeks and weeks playing with spatial indexes. I find them fascinating. But that's not really a good use of my time. Well, it may be a good use of my time. It's not a good use of your time. Because for all the time that you waste trying to squeeze milliseconds out of your spatial index performance, it's probably kind of a wash at the end of the day. What Chet is going to show you quickly in this next demo is some sort of hard and fast rules with working with SQL Server spatial indexes. There are a couple of magic bullets, and then everything else, you're probably not ever going to earn back the time that you spent tuning in overall performance of those indexes. So maybe one year we can stop talking about spatial indexes, but everyone always thinks that that's going to be the thing that's going to make it really fast. But before I turn this over to Chet, back to that benchmarking, you got to understand that there's nowhere else that you can improve performance before you start tweaking little things. And I think the spatial index kind of falls into that category. So there are a couple of best practices Chet's going to cover, and then that's about it. And before I turn it over to Chet, we have this great slide here. If you've got the events app on your phone, we would really appreciate it if you filled out the survey about this session. We get the feedback. We really appreciate the feedback. And it helps us make sessions better from year to year. If you go to this session and you just scroll down to the bottom of it, you will see a bunch of survey questions that you can answer right now. So while Chet is demoing, we will do that, and then we will take questions afterwards.
All right, so I'm inside of Pro right now. I've got four feature classes on the left-hand side over in the contents area. And these are basically different versions of the same feature class. So I'm going to tell a little bit about each one, and then we'll take a look at some of the properties, and then we'll look at the performance of how these are behaving in the database. So the first one at the bottom of the list is a feature class that I've created with just a small amount of data. It's a parcel feature class, and it has maybe 30 or 40 rows in it. And everything was just copied and pasted into the database in that fashion. I just copied the data in, and my feature class was created with a minimal amount of rows. The next one, I went in and I actually loaded a million more parcels into that feature class. And so I've got a much bigger feature class, but there's some things about it that I want you to see. We'll get to that. The third one, I actually fixed the problems with the second feature class, and we'll talk about that. And then the fourth one is a similar effect, but in this case, I actually created an empty feature class, and then I appended that same million rows into that feature class, and we'll take a look at what happens there. So before I get too far into actually running it, I've got these images that I want to show. We'll pop them all up on the screen. There we go. And you'll see on the left-hand side, these are my two images of information I took from the first feature class, where it's a small feature class with just a little bit of data. And on the right-hand side is the one where I appended a million records into that same one. So if we look at the top images, we've got my feature class extent, and you can see the values there. It's a large number. I'm not going to try to call all of those out. And if you look at the right-hand side and compare where I appended that million features into that same feature class, my feature class extent is much larger. You can see that I've got a 2 million number rather than a 1 million number. But if we look at the bottom, you have the spatial index information from those two feature classes. Spatial index is not managed by ArcGIS. You can recalculate your spatial index. You can drop your spatial index and add it again, which is essentially a recalculate. But we do not automatically do this for you. So when you're appending data into a empty feature class or into one that had some data before, we're not regrowing or shrinking that spatial index. What you set is what you want, what you end up with at the end. So before and after, those two are exactly the same thing. Now let's look at how that's going to affect our behavior. So we'll turn on the first feature class, and let's just make sure. I think I had the trace running. No, let's turn that trace on. We'll let that run in the background and capture what's going on in the database as we turn these on. So I'll turn on the first one. Pops up. This is what you would expect. This is how fast you want to see your data happen all the time. Let's turn on the next one. Okay, I turned it on. Is anybody getting bored of waiting for my data to show up? So we're just going to let that run. It's actually taking much longer than I expected it to. I'm going to turn on the third one while we're waiting on that. And you know what? We'll turn on the fourth one too. We'll maybe lock Pro up.
Yeah, that's kind of a risky
maneuver
in a demo.
It's okay. Did we crash Pro? Let's look at what's happening in the trace. Maybe that'll tell us what's actually going on. So we see the first query came through. It was 141 milliseconds. It seems like maybe my database is running a little slower than it should be, because this yesterday was running in maybe 30
milliseconds. 14
or something. 14. The other ones have not even came through yet. Obviously, I have got some sort of performance issue with that second feature class. There it comes. It took 59 seconds. Now, that's maybe a little dramatic. I think these numbers are a little inflated, because these other two came back in 6 seconds. So I guess what I want to show here is, let's not pay attention to what these numbers are, but let's look at the ratio between them. So all of the numbers are a little more inflated than I expect, but if you notice, the 60 seconds versus 6 seconds, that's a huge difference. I would expect a million records not even to take 6 seconds to draw. I think yesterday it was still under a second. The 30 or 40 rows was way low into the milliseconds. And even the last one, where I created this feature class empty, and then loaded all of that data in, it's around 6 seconds. Whatever that number might be, you just want to pay attention to how your spatial index is affecting what your data is. Now, why is the last one important? Why is that last one important? Because when we create an empty feature class in ArcGIS, we're going to create it with a bounding box that's the size of your coordinate system. So whatever coordinate system you input, that's how big your bounding box for your spatial index is going to be. In the past, when we were using the manual grids back in 2008, where you had to set medium, 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 high, 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 medium, high, low, whatever you were doing, that really big bounding box for your spatial index made a big difference. Now that we're in 2012 and later, and we're using the SQL Server's auto grid index, this number really isn't different. It's actually a little faster than that second one. Yesterday it was a little slower. But you can see that having that huge bounding box for your spatial index in this case isn't going to make much of a difference. The thing that you don't want to have is a very tiny spatial index and a lot of data outside of it, because SQL Server is just going to say, none of that is indexed. I need to check all of that data before I send you your results. And that's pretty much what I wanted to show there.
How much of the spatial index stuff you're showing applies if you're still using an SQL binary for your storage and your geometry?
None of this will apply to that. Yeah.
Yeah, this is all specifically for the SQL Server spatial types and their spatial index.
Right.
So the rule of thumb with the spatial types is, if you're using geometry, if you're using geography, the extent is always the extent of the globe. If you're using geometry, you can put whatever extent you want in there. SQL Server had this rather bold plan when it created the spatial types of saying you can put it, you know, 249 different spatial indexes on a single spatial column, because maybe you want to have different indexes in different areas that are built a different way, except the optimizer can't pick and choose between them, so it just takes the first one. So the AutoGrid index was kind of their dialing it back a bit and saying, all right, let's just see if we can create an index that kind of works well enough for everything. What we found with the AutoGrid index, it's 8 layers of grids. You can't customize the granularity of those layers, but having 8 layers means that most of your data ends up being indexed in different cells. When you had the 4 layers of cell and you had an enormous bounding box, like the entire globe, and your data was, you know, San Diego County, most of your data was going to end up in the same index tile. So it was basically like not having an index. Whereas with the auto grid, because there are an additional 4 layer levels of grid down there that the features can be referenced by, that the system was much better. And you ended up, I mean, the rule that applies to binary as well as to geometry data is that you want your spatial index to help you filter your data. And so if you have shapes that are kind of uniquely referenced by a single index tile, rather than all of your shapes falling in one tile, that index is going to be useful. No index is going to be ideal for all of your data in a feature class unless your data is completely uniform boxes spread across the surface. But when there, and you know, points can work out pretty well. But otherwise, you're always going to end up with some features that are bigger and some features that are smaller. So you just want your index to be good enough. And what we wanted to show you here is, if you're using an AutoGrid index and you have a really big bounding box, hey, you're fine. The thing you really want to avoid is a bounding box that is smaller than the extent of your data, because that is going to be essentially like not having a spatial index. The other thing you want to make sure is that SQL Server is actually using the spatial index. With SDBinary, it's ArcGIS that tells it to use a spatial index, but with SQL Server, it's the index optimizer that is going to pick a query plan that may or may not use a spatial index. And they've made a lot of improvements in SQL Server over the past few releases to the optimizer, specifically for knowing when to choose a spatial index. So if you're on 2008, 2012, I would recommend up. 2016 has made a lot of inroads with performance related to the optimizer, related to how spatial data behaves. But earlier releases, the optimizer often failed to choose a spatial index. when it would have been much more performant to do so. In 2008? So 2008 didn't have an AutoGrid index. So the question is, what's the advice for 2008 instances? I would make sure that the extent of my index matches fairly closely the extent of my feature class. Beyond that, it kind of depends on the size of my features. You know, Microsoft defaults to the medium. You can play around with different granularity. You know, if you have a really big, sparsely spread out feature class, or you've got points, you may want to go with a high level at the top, and break that initial extent down into a smaller number of pieces. The biggest bang for the buck, though, is making sure that the extent of your index is fairly closely tied to the extent of your feature class. When you go to AutoGrid, that's less important. It can be bigger. But with manual grid, I think the biggest performance gain we saw was making sure that it fairly closely matched. And if you rebuild your index using ArcGIS tools, or not rebuild, if you recalculate your index, it will create a new index with the extent of your data set.
Mm-hmm. What sort of how do I set up an index for that?
You would build a spatial index on that column.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I can still use an RTIS tool to
build
a spatial index. A SQL server will recognize that?
The tool will build a SQL server index.
Right.
Yeah. So if you right click on your feature class and you go to the property sheet and you go to indexes and you go down to the spatial index, if it is a SQL server spatial type, it will present you with information about recalculating the index. You can even, in earlier releases, specify your own parameters.
Right. When we were using the medium.
When we're using AutoGrid, you don't specify that granularity, but when it's the manual grid, you did. So that's all fine. You can do the same thing in SQL Server. Either way.
No,
it's just we will automatically calculate the extent for you when you use ArcGIS tools.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I have automatic backups running on
these? So can you have automatic backups?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maintenance plan. There's a maintenance plan in the SQL Server that you can do it. That's one way. But
yeah,
there's tons of tools out there to do
yeah.
backups.
Yeah, so we don't provide anything in our software because there's so much other stuff out there built into SQL Server, and also there are a lot of third-party tools that will give you a really nice front end for maintaining backups, and you can have them run automatically. Backups can take place in SQL Server with everybody connected and working.
Right.
So there's you know, no downtime at all when you do SQL Server backups. Yeah. So I was going to say, you had a question way back during the presentation. They would all need to connect as the same user.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
No.
No, there's no way that multiple different users using ArcGIS can write to the same schema.
Right. You saw how the group, when I created the group and it made the user, and I added the user, and it created that new table under the user schema, not the group schema. That's the effect that you're going to see.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If it was working for you, keep doing it. If it's something that was a hassle to do, it's not as relevant anymore with I mean, you still want to make sure that the extent is larger than the extent of your data. But with the manual grids, you also had to make sure, like the example Chet showed for the last feature class, where when you create an empty feature class, we're going to create a spatial index that matches the extent of the feature class, which we don't know yet because there's no data in it, so it's enormous. And there were definite performance problems with indexes with a manual grid doing that. When you then loaded this little chunk of data and all of the features possibly ended up in a single index cell, so it was almost like not having an index because the extent of the index was so massive. So the way the SQL Server spatial index works is that they will take that extent and they will divide it up into the first level of tiles. And if that in a manual grid was set to, say, medium, you would get 64 tiles. And then the next level would break each tile down into whatever the granularity was, say, another 64 tiles. So you'd go down and you would end up with X number of tiles at the lowest level that covered your extent. But if your extent was the whole Earth and you were dealing with a set of points in a very localized area, they could all end up in a single index cell or, you know, one or two cells. And that just negates the purpose of the index. So that was much more of a factor for manual grid because you only had four levels to index with. So we recommended there that you kept an eye on things. And if you had created an empty feature class, you ended up with this huge box, it was important to go back and recalculate it to fit your data. But when you're using an auto grid, more often than not, I'm not saying always this is the case, because you may end up with such tiny data and such a large extent that it could be indexed better with a smaller extent. But in Chet's example, it really didn't make that much of a difference having an extent that was your coordinate reference and loading up a little bit of data. I mean, he was dealing with very localized parcels. And it because there are eight levels of grid in an auto grid, most of your data ends up being indexed separately. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, I mean, you can take a look at it. What we've found really is the auto grid is always as good or possibly better than the manual grid. Yeah, and there's just a little bit less babysitting to do with it. Yeah, this is all SQL Server. These are SQL Server indexes, and it's the SQL Server optimizer that decides whether to use them or not. Yeah, yeah.
It's only available in what version?
Well, the spatial types were introduced in 2008. So the manual grid was 2008. In 2012, they introduced the auto grid. And they're both available. At 10.3.1, we started defaulting to say, if you have 2012, we're automatically creating an auto-grid index for you. In 10.3 and earlier, we were still using the manual grid index as the default. But you can go in and change it at the SQL Server level to be whatever you want it to be.
Where would you go to change that? Is it in the actual instance?
Yeah, go to the...
If you go into SQL Server, you go to your table and open up the indexes on your table, and you will see an option for a spatial index if there is one. Yeah.